Very good. So, thank you. The relationship which you have to the world. Now, I'm sure that you have seen me many times. Oh, at least those people looking after me. Because no matter what you ever have to do in life, you know, there's always a relationship of never complaining. Because if you complain, no one listens anyway. So it's a total waste of time. And also, we try and not have a fault-finding mind. Sometimes that people are just so negative, they can find fault with anything. And as for me, whatever happens, if you are sick, if you are healthy, no matter what happens in life, you don't need to find fault. You can have a beautiful relationship. But the problem is when you try and control the world and get it just the way you want it, instead of adapting to the world. Now that is where we have our problems. It reminds me of one of my stories when I always thought that being a monk meant you could have a lot of peace and quiet and no one would disturb you. You can sit in your cave meditating all day and all week and all year and be a lovely hermit and be really happy. But that's not what happened. Because on one occasion, it was the holiest day of the Buddhist calendar, Vaisak Day. And commemorating the Buddha's birth, enlightenment, final passing away in Theravada Buddhism in Thailand. And I was in a beautiful monastery in the north of Thailand with lots of caves. I was meditating, have a wonderful time. But on that day, so many people came to the temple. It was really noisy. And many of those people, they came to talk to me. And I thought, okay, if you want to know about Buddhism, if you want to know about meditation, fine, I can answer your questions. But you know what they asked me? They asked me, where are you from? What does your mother and father do? How many brothers and sisters have you? Always the same stupid questions. And so after about 30 or 40 people came up to me asking, where are you from? What does your mother and father do? How many brothers and sisters have you got? Why did you come to Thailand? I got so fed up that I asked, you have your tricks, how to get away from people. And my trick is, I need to go to the toilet. But you know, sometimes that doesn't work, because I was giving a talk in Hong Kong, and when I was giving a talk in Hong Kong, this was in Singapore. I was transiting through Singapore. I was really tired of giving some talks in the west coast of the United States. And as I got into Singapore airport, I thought, I have a bit of a rest, a bit of peace and quiet. But I have so many disciples who actually work in the airport that they were waiting for me at the gate. And they sat me down, gave me a cup of tea, and started talking about their meditation and questions about Dhamma. And even as a monk, sometimes you get fed up with that. And I was tired, so I thought, how can I escape from these people? So I said, I need to go to the toilet. And my plan was to go into the toilet and sit on that seat as long as I possibly could and get a bit of peace and quiet. So I went into the toilet, and as soon as I got, this is no exaggeration, I went into the toilet in the airport in Singapore, looking for some peace and quiet. And as soon as I went into that, the toilet place, the toilet attendant inside the airport looked at me and said, you're Ajahn Brahm, can I ask you some questions on meditation? Even in the toilet I can't escape. It's really unfair. So anyway, on this monastery, I asked to go to the toilet. So I went there. And as soon as I came out, I looked around like some spy. They weren't looking in my directions. So I rushed to my hut, got my bottle, a flashlight, and a bottle of water, a flashlight, and what else did I get? Just a cushion. And I sneaked into one of the caves in the monastery. A really deep cave. Going round and round on this chamber and that chamber until I got to the deepest part of the cave. And I put my cushion down, had my bottle of water, and I started meditating.
peace at last. Only for about 10 minutes. And then I heard a noise. It was people coming in the cave. Because the abbot there was supposed to be giving a talk, a sermon. But they were so fed up and bored with this abbot's droning on about all sorts of ridiculous stuff. Instead of listening to the talk, they decided to explore my cave. And as they came closer, there was a bend in the cave. I could see the light of their lantern as it came closer and closer. And then one of these Thai men, they put their head around the corner. And they screamed and went back. I could understand Thai fluently. Because what they said, I could hear them. There's a ghost in the end of the cave. And I thought, yes, it's the ghost, okay, get out of here. Because Thai people are terrified of ghosts. But then two people put their head around the corner. And one of them said, no, it's not a ghost, it's a Western monk. No, it's a ghost, no, it's a Western monk. So they checked again. And they said, oh, it's a Western monk. So about 10 of them came right up to me. And then they asked, what country do you come from? What does your father do? What does your mother do? How many brothers and sisters have you got? And I realized from experiences like that, you can't control your life. You try and plan it out, but in the end, all plans go wrong. It never works out the way you want it to. So instead of planning the life, you just let life happen. And your relationship to the world is like almost surfing. You just go with the waves. You never, ever fight them. It is the fighting with life which causes you the problems. But going with life, making the best out of it, and laughing when things go wrong. Now that is the way to have a good relationship with life. And that means that whatever happens in life, you can always learn, have fun with it. So, the big relationship you have in life with your husband, with your wife, with your partner. It's amazing how many people come to me for marriage counseling. I don't know why they do that. I have never been married. What do you come to ask me these questions for? But I figured it out why they come and ask a monk. You know why they come and ask a monk for counseling? Because we're cheap. You go to one of these professional marriage counselors, you have to pay through the nose for them. Monks, very cheap, give them a cup of tea and they'll answer any question for you. So we're really cheap. But you know, just because we're cheap, don't ever think that we're not worth it. Because this has happened many, many times. There was once somebody rang up and they said, we hear you teach meditation. I said, yeah, I teach meditation. I'm quite a well-known meditation teacher. I've written many books on meditation. So this lady then asked, well, how much do you charge? I said, I don't charge anything. It's for free. And she replied, well, if it's for free, you can't be any good then. And she hung up. That's what it's like in the Western world. If it's good, you have to pay for it. So I never say that anymore. We changed our marketing strategy. And so when people ask, how much does it cost? We never say it's for free. We say, it is priceless. Which is much nicer. And also, you just don't like having to sell things and make, you know, pay for things. That doesn't sort of feel right for me as a monk. So I learned all this myself for free. So we give it out for free. And so all this counseling and stuff is for free. So when you do get married, what do you do? And we have some really, really nice stories about the relationship you have with your partner. Now, I think I mentioned this afternoon just one important story, and that was about just looking the bride's eyes, looking the husband's eyes, say, from now on, you don't think of yourself. From now on, you don't think of your partner. How many of you heard that this afternoon? The most of you, okay. Oh, you did. Okay, well, I'll do it very quickly. It doesn't take time. In marriages, now you do the blessing services for them, and a bit of counseling.
And I really volunteer to do that because I know once they're married, if they have any problems in their marriage, they come and bother me. And I like an easy life. So I get it right from the very beginning. Get right in the beginning, tell them what to do rightly, and then they're fine for the rest of their life. And I have an easy life with them. So I don't mind doing marriage blessings to make sure it's all right from the beginning so I don't get bothered later on. So I look at the bride in her eyes. This is in Australia, probably the same in Canada. I look in her eyes and say, today you're getting married. From this moment on, you must never think of yourself. And she always smiles and nods. Then I look at the groom, the guy, and say, from this moment on, you must not think of yourself either. And I don't know what it is in Australia, with guys in Australia. They always pause for a while, first of all. They think it over. Is it the same in Canada? The girls say yes. You must not think of yourself. But eventually he gives in, okay. And then looking at the guy, I said, from this moment on, you must not think of your wife. And look at the wife, from this moment on, you must not think of your husband. And that's a beautiful moment because they get so confused. You know, when they're getting married, they really listen to you. When they're in an audience, sometimes they text, message, and do all sorts of things. But when they're married, it's important. They listen. And then they try to figure out, what the heck does this crazy monk mean? Don't think of yourself. Don't think of your partner. So because in a marriage, you must only think of us. Don't think of yourself. Don't think of the other. Only us. And that's one of the great secrets of a relationship. Because if you're just thinking about yourself, it's selfishness. That's not a relationship at all. That's not a marriage. But even worse than that, when you start thinking of the other all the time and sacrificing yourself for the other, you soon get burnt out. That's not a marriage either. So in a marriage, we don't think of ourselves, we don't think of our partner, we only think of us. And if there's any problem, whose problem is it? Ours. Yes, that's what a relationship means. We're in it together. It will always be our problem. And when it's always our problem, we can always solve it in life. If it's his problem, her problem, look, how many of you have been married to a guy? If it's his problem, is he ever going to solve it? If it's her problem, if it's my problem, there's no solution there. It is always our problem. And one of the reasons it's a problem is because I don't know why you guys don't understand what marriage is. I'm a monk, I understand everything about marriage. As you will soon find out. Now, one of the things in a marriage is well described by this story. And it's my famous story of the chicken and the duck. One of my favorite stories. A couple who had just been married, maybe for a few weeks. After lunch one day, they went for a walk in the forest. As they were walking happily in the forest, they heard a sound. Quack, quack. Quack, quack. And the wife said, oh, darling, can you hear that? That is a chicken. And he said, what do you say, darling? That's a chicken. He said, no, it's not a chicken, darling. That is a duck. Said, no, 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 that's a chicken. He said, it's a duck. Quack, quack, it went again. So he said, that's a duck. She said, no, I am sure that is a chicken. He said, it can't be. It's a duck. But she said, it's a chicken. And he said, it's a duck. But she said, it's a chicken. And he said, it's a duck. D-U-C-K, duck. I enjoy telling this story. And then she started to cry. It's a chicken. Don't make me laugh. I've got to finish this story. Stop making me laugh. And then he looked into her eyes and saw her tears. And he realized why he married her and what's important in a marriage. So he squeezed her hand gently and said, darling,
I think you may be right. There is a chicken. And she looked into his eyes and smiled and said, thank you, darling. And it went quack, quack again. And they had a wonderful, happy walk in the forest. And that evening, he got a hot dinner. And the moral of that story is, who gives a damn whether it's a chicken or a duck? Is that really important? Is that worth sacrificing a happy day with your partner? So, this is the first lesson in that story. In a relationship, especially in a marriage, sometimes we forget what's important. We sacrifice what is important for just trying to be right. And the second part of that story is, you know, just because it goes quack, quack, it doesn't necessarily mean it's a duck. That could have been a chicken from Fukushima nuclear disaster zone, which now goes quack, quack. And how many times have you thought you were right and it turns out you were wrong? Many times that has happened to you. So just assume you may be wrong. And if she says it's a chicken, it's a chicken. Even though it goes quack, quack or woof, woof, who cares? But that's so important in a relationship, to realize priorities. What is really important and what is not important. And you'll find in a relationship, most of your arguments, the ones which really hurt, those are the ones about trivial matters. And that story does solve many marital problems. Simple story. But I think any of you who've been married know how you start to argue. There's an old saying, in the first year of a marriage, the husband listens to the wife. In the second year of marriage, the wife listens to the husband. In the third year of marriage, the neighbors listen to both of you. You're arguing so loud. And don't be like that. So this is understanding what's important in life. And I remember 6 months after I performed a marriage for a couple, the wife came up to see me to thank me for saving her marriage. Because after they were married, you know, they had, you know, things they had to decide together. And her husband would never argue with her. Never argued once in 6 months. And she got very upset. And she confronted him and said, why aren't you concerned about the matters which are, you know, affect our marriage? Why do you just stand there just like some dummy when I'm speaking and never sort of say anything back? And that's when her husband just said to his wife, chickens and ducks. And she remembered the story and how that the husband was not going to argue with his wife over trivial matters. And she said they never argued since. What a beautiful marriage that is. It's not worth it. So in a relationship, this is most important. And I really wanted somehow or other to get that story told in the parliament in Ottawa. See if these people could not sort of argue with each other, but listen to each other for goodness sake. Because this is the relationship we have to the world. Not arguing with it, not fault finding, but working with the world. Never working against it. Because why do we argue so much? Why is it we have so many different religions? So many different sects within the religion. Now there's a very old Buddhist story, you know, which many other people know about. But I'm going to give it a twist afterwards. So the main story is the old story of the seven blind men and the elephant. And that story was these blind men. And they'd been blind since the day they were born. And one day they were sitting together and talking about elephants. What is an elephant? We've never seen an elephant because they've been blind. So they decided to all go around to different parts and find an elephant and feel it so they could know what an elephant was. So the first blind man found an elephant and came back to the others and said, oh, an elephant is a snake. Because he'd felt the trunk. Another man had felt the tusks and said, oh, an elephant is a plow. They used to dig the fields. And another guy said, "You idiots, it can't be a plow or a snake," because he had felt the ears. It's one of those fans they use in the old places to keep you cool in the hot weather. I mean, you don't have fans in Halifax because it's never hot.
Maybe it is in the summertime when I come here.
And the one who felt the head said, "I said it's a big water pot." The guy who felt the body said, "No, it's a rock." The guy who felt the legs said, "It can't be a rock, it's a tree trunk." And the one who felt the tail said it was a fly whisk. And everybody was perfectly sure that they were right, because they had felt it, they had experienced it. And they argued and had a fight over what an elephant was. If only, instead of fighting each other, religions, political parties, instead of fighting each other, "I am right, this is what an elephant is." Imagine if they just met together and combined their experiences of what life is. And then they would have found an elephant is a big rock on four tree trunks with a fly whisk at the back, a big water pot on the front, with two big fans on either side, a snake in the middle, and just under the snake, two plows. And that would be a pretty good description of an elephant for someone who's never seen one. Now that is what I try and teach people, how not to argue, but how to listen to one another and respect one another's views and combine them. And after that story, some blind elephants, seven blind elephants, they heard about this story because they'd always been blind since birth and they wondered what a man was. And having heard that story, they decided, "Well, we've been blind since we were born, we elephants. The only way we can know what a man is to find one, feel the man, and come back and compare our experiences." But unlike the first part of the story, when the elephants, they found a man each, they felt the man, when they came back, they all agreed. And a man was flat.
That's the only way elephants can feel things.
Well, I managed to tell that joke to the Prime Minister of Australia and the Treasurer once. They enjoyed that. So we combine our knowledge. And actually, to go on this tangent, I mean, there's a few pastors here, I understand. Are they here this evening? There's a nice Muslim lady at the end. Well, anyway, if they're not, you can tell them this story afterwards. Because someone asked Buddhists, and many of you are Buddhists, "Okay, you're a Buddhist. You know, well, what's your idea of God then?" And, you know, as you're a Catholic, what do Buddhists think of God? And to give that answer to the Buddhist idea of God, there was one time I was giving a presentation at our local university. I think it was a chaplaincy conference. Together with a very good friend of mine, he was the abbot of a Benedictine Catholic monastery close to Perth. We only had two monasteries in Western Australia, so we'd meet together and we'd discuss abbot business, the only two abbots in the state. And you know, we were very, very close friends. He had a great sense of humour, this guy, Abbot Placid, Benedictine. He died only a few years ago, and you know, when he died, you know, I was invited to the funeral mass to give a speech. It wasn't even any Anglicans there, you know, let alone a Buddhist, because they realized I was a close friend and they allowed me to come in and give a speech. And I was very honored to do that because he was a really close friend. And I love that man. And I remember him when we had discussions, now many, many discussions. I remember actually asking him once, you know, he said, "You're a Catholic, do you believe in ghosts?" And apparently, in the Catholic Church, they don't believe in ghosts. And I asked him, "Do you believe in ghosts?" He said, "No, no, no, we don't believe in ghosts. How about the Holy Ghost then?" Ha, 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 caught you. So we'd be cheeky to each other, because we were good friends. And anyway, Anyway, he would always tell me this story. He said one of his fundamental beliefs as a Catholic, as a contemplative Catholic monk, was that everybody is searching for God. Now, I respect a person. I do not deny, you know, his reality. So when I was asked this question, what do Buddhists think of God, by this fellow who is a very prominent Australian, a Father Frank Brennan, you know, he's employed by the government to look into a human rights part of the Australian Constitution. He's very, very prominent, very smart guy. And I realized I couldn't tell a joke to this guy. I had to be serious. So I said, look, this Abbot Placid has always been telling me that his fundamental belief is that everyone is searching for God. So what do Buddhists search for? All you Buddhists here, what are you searching for? You're searching for truth, respect, to love and be loved, for peace, for insight. So if that's what Buddhists are searching for, and everyone is searching for God, then that must be what God is. So the Buddhist idea of God is what you're searching for truth, peace, meaning, respect is important, love. So there we go. That's the Buddhist idea of God. And this Father Frank Brennan, high intellectual, said, wow, that's a really nice answer. Not only because it's truthful, but also because it's the truth which breaks down the barriers between religions, which allows us to understand each other, respect each other, and live side by side together. And for me, any truth which divides people, any sort of insights which create more problems in this world, cannot be the truth, cannot be Dharma in Buddhism. It has to be things which solve problems, not make more problems. So that is a Buddhist definition of God and the relation we have to each other in this world. But the best story of the relations we have to people who don't think the same as us, especially people who follow different religions, is the great old story, one of my favorites, of the old man and the violin. Now, this is a story in some far-off country of an old man. Oh, actually, he was young when the story started. And he lived up in the mountains, a simple farmer. And like many parents do, he worked so hard. And the meaning of his life was bringing up his children, making sure they got a good education. And at great extra cost to himself, working really hard to send his kids to university. And his kids, they passed their examinations, they became doctors, they became engineers, they became sort of business people. And once they got themselves established in the city, they decided to invite their father up from the mountains and the poor villages where he'd worked all his life, invite the father to the city for the very, very first time. And when they invited the father to the city for the first time, the father saw things he never ever expected to see before. I'm going to go off a tangent here because it's time for a joke. He went in to a supermarket in the mall, and he couldn't believe. He saw there milk powder. Just add water and you get fresh milk. He thought, wow, this is amazing. Up in the village where I live, you have to find a cow. And you have to pull the udders to get milk. Here, all you need to do is get this powder and add water. This is amazing. And then, on another aisle in the supermarket, instant mashed potatoes. Just add water, mashed potato powder. Just add water and you get potatoes. He said, up in the mountains, we have to dig the soil, put in these seed potatoes, wait for a while. And then we have to harvest them, and then we get the potato, we have to wash it and peel it and boil it, and then we mash it, and then we get mashed potatoes. Here in the city, you just get powder and add hot water, and you get instant mashed potatoes. It's amazing. And then when he went into another aisle, He couldn't believe his eyes. Baby powder. Up in the village, we have to have a woman.
Okay, you get the joke.
So anyway. The other joke. Here we go. Some of you may have seen this, heard this one before. And he went into sort of the supermarket and he saw this incredible thing that had these two doors and they opened up. You know, it was an elevator, lift. He hadn't seen one before. You don't have elevators in the village. So he saw this old lady go in the elevator and the doors closed. And he saw these numbers appear on the top. You know, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. And it stopped. And then he saw 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. And then the elevator doors opened. And he saw this young secretary walk out. He saw this old woman walk in, a young woman walk out. So he said to his son, "Can you bring your mother over here?" That's a guy's joke, okay? Anyway,
sorry about this.
Anyway, so serious part of the story. He heard a terrible sound while he was exploring the city. The worst sound he'd ever heard in his life. It was a terrible noise. But he was always inquisitive. So he insisted on finding where this really awful noise came from. So he followed the sound into the room in the back of a house where he saw this young boy, maybe about 5 or 6 years of old, playing a violin. Now, being a simple man with no education, he thought that's what a violin sounds like, and he never wanted to hear such a terrible instrument again in his life. The next day, a different part of the city, he heard a beautiful sound. He followed that to its source, and I think you've already run ahead of me. What he saw was an old woman, maybe 60 or 70, playing a violin. It was so sweet. It made him tremble with joy. She was a maestro. She'd been practicing all her life on the violin. And now he realized it wasn't the violin's fault. It was just the boy had yet to learn how to play it sweetly. And he thought, that's the same when we criticize religions in our modern world. It's nothing to do with the religion. It's the person hasn't learned how to play it properly yet. So the next part of the story is the best. In another part of the city, he heard the most beautiful sound he'd ever heard in his life. It was more thrilling than the sound of the creek up in the mountains after a heavy rain. It was more soothing than the sound of the wind ruffling the leaves in the forest. And more beautiful than the sound of the birds in the early morning. It was the most beautiful sound he'd ever heard in his life. You know what that sound was? An orchestra. It was the most beautiful sound for two reasons. First, every member of that orchestra was a maestro of their own instrument. They had learned how to play their instrument so sweetly, first of all. And then secondly, and most importantly, then they learn how to play together in harmony. That's why he said it was the most beautiful sound in the world. And he said, wouldn't it be wonderful with all the religions in the world? First, you learn to play your religion sweetly first. But don't stop there. Then learn how to play with other religions in harmony. What a beautiful sound that will be in our world. Now that's what the relationship we have to religions is all about. And what a beautiful world that would be. And how we do learn from one another. It's much of Islam which I like. I love the Sufis. Especially Nasruddin. Nasruddin. He's this fellow in sort of the Islamic tradition. He's supposed to live in Iran. And I love many of his stories. I quote them many times because they're full of wisdom, like, you know, some of the stories I make up or the Buddha stories. One of his stories, because we were talking earlier about children. Now, how children just, we think they're different. You know, they've got all these mobile phones these days and they never talk to each other. They always text each other. But children have always been a problem to their parents. Even Socrates, you know, he wrote, children these days are a big problem. And that was just, you know, how many years ago? 2,400 years ago. In Greek, kids don't change, as this story, you know, from this Nasruddin shows you. Because Nasruddin, he was telling the story of when he used to be in the salt trade. Now, he had a couple of donkeys, and they put the salt on the donkey's back, and they would take the salt from one place to another to sell. And his son would be his assistant. And on the journey, they had to go across a narrow bridge, across a river. And if the donkey was leaning to the left and about to fall into the river, the father will tell the son, push the donkey to the left. That was leaning to the left. The reason the father said, push the donkey to the left, because the father knew whatever he said to his son would always do the opposite. So if the donkey was leaning to the right, and he wanted to push to the left, he'd tell his son, push it to the right. And that system worked perfectly, until one day they were crossing a river, and the donkey was leaning to the right, and so the father said, push the donkey to the right. And the son, for the first time, followed the father's instructions and pushed it to the right, and it fell in. He said, what did you do that for? And the son said, I followed your instructions. We never did that before. Oh, yes, don't you remember, Father? Today is my 21st birthday. I'm not a teenager anymore. So this is what kids do sometimes. Not just kids, but even adults too. As this story shows, because sometimes even Australian husbands are like this. Because I had this Buddhist, she was, I think, Malaysian, Chinese Buddhist. And she came to my temple, she read my books, she loved Buddhism, was helping her in her life. And of course, if something is really helping you, you want to share it with the people you love. It's obvious. And so she was trying and trying and trying to get her Australian husband to come to my temple to learn a bit of meditation, but he absolutely refused. No way was he going to come to any stupid religion. And so she came to me and said, look, Ajahn Brahm, help, how can I get my husband to sort of, I'm sure he would love it if he only sort of listened to it. I said, it's so easy. I know this as a monk, never be married. Buy a copy of my book. You know, like the Dung book or whatever. Buy a copy of my book and then take it home. And as soon as you get home, tell your husband, keep your filthy hands off this. This is my book. Ban him from reading it. It's so obvious. And so she, you know what happens. She did that. And her husband, you're not allowed. This is my holy book. Keep your hands off it. Okay? And once she was out shopping, a few days later, you know what husbands are like. If the wife says don't do it, they're like that sort of teenage son. The wife says, you have to do it. You know, it's tradition, it's whatever. So as soon as she was out shopping, he saw the book. He said, what do you mean I can't look at this? I can look at whatever I want. And he started reading it. He didn't put it down until he finished, and now he comes to the temple every week. Mission accomplished. This is the way you do things in life, when you understand just how life works. So your relationship to life is what knowing how life works, not asking of the life what you can't, what it can't give you, and working with life. So your relationship to life is not about me, it's not about life, it's all about us, and how we can work together with life. So it's the same with, you know, your career. I don't know what you want to do in your career and whether you really, really, really want to be wealthy. I know some people, they do. They're absolutely stupid. They just want to be really wealthy in their life. And you know, the social research has proved again and again and again. If you make too much money, you know, it's a big problem for you. You know, you have to worry about investing it, and there's so many sort of dodgy investment companies out there. You know, what if I do the stock market? Is it going to go up? Is it going to go down? Or should I invest in property? And you have to think and watch the newspapers or Bloomberg every day. It's such pressure on you to try and maintain, you know, your riches. And so if you're too rich, it's a lot of suffering. If you're too poor and you can't afford things, you can't afford holidays, look after your kids, give them a good education, being too poor is also a problem. So sociologists had worked out the optimum income as far as happiness is concerned. Too much money and it's too much problems. Too little money, just you can't enjoy life. And I know when I first read this, they worked out it's roughly about, in Australia, it was $50,000 per person. That was a few years ago. So maybe now it's about $80,000, no, Canadian dollars, roughly. I think that's about right. If you're earning less than $80,000 for your family, it's a lot of problems for you. If you're earning more than $80,000, it's a lot of problems for you. So anyone here is earning more than $80,000, I can help you become happier. Donation box over there. You know, I try that so often, it never works. But there's an optimum. So your relationship towards life. Now, sometimes don't try and be wealthy. And the other thing I like to ask people, you know, Halifax is not bad. You know, your houses are not too big, but some of them are already a bit big. The biggest houses in the world, apparently, I read this in the newspapers, are in Australia. And I remember going to this lady's house once, you know, for a little ceremony. And as soon as I arrived, 1 hour from my monastery, this is no joke, absolutely true, as soon as I arrived, I asked to go to the toilet. It was a mansion. No exaggeration, she had to draw me a map how to get to the toilet. These days, mansions come with their own GPS. It's the only way you can get around them. And when I went to this lady's house, and it's a huge mansion, I asked how many people live here. And she said, only me. And that was so sad. That just went right into my heart, that poor lady. I said, why? She said, well, I'm afraid of all my relations and friends, that when they come round, they'd ask for my money. Her riches had separated her from all her friends and all her relations because she couldn't trust any of them. And I thought, how sad that was. She was a prisoner in her own mansion, not allowing anybody in. Now, if you're, you know, poor or reasonable, you're not afraid of people. Now, even I was very poor, as I mentioned. My father, being sick, you know, was in and out of work. But our home, you know, we never bother to lock the door. And in fact, my father was actually quite hopeful that a burglar would come in one day, take pity on us and leave something. So when you're not poor, you don't need very much. But the best thing about growing up in a poor house was that you had to share rooms with everybody. I had to share a room with my brother throughout the whole of my life. Yeah, we fought, but there's no escape. We had to learn how to settle our differences. And you'd always see your mum and dad. And sometimes, one of the things I remember is seeing my mum and dad argue. They'd argue and they'd refuse to speak to each other for about an hour. And then they'd make up. And I saw them make up. And for a young kid, that was such a beautiful thing to see. What I learned, because my parents couldn't escape from their kids, it was too small an apartment, what I learned, that arguments is natural. We do argue with one another. We do have different ideas of what to do. It's just like the elephant and the blind men. But the nicest thing was, we have the argument, we always make up, because our love together is more important than being right. I learned that from seeing my parents. But if you have a big house, Your daughter is in her room. Your son is in his room. Your husband's in the office. The wife's in the kitchen. I'm just being stereotyping, but you never see one another. And one of the stories I have is of this woman who won the British lottery. I think I said this yesterday, didn't I? Okay, so it's there somewhere. She won the British lottery, £46 million. £46 or £47 million. So a lot of money to win. And once she won, she bought this big mansion in the countryside of Sussex in England. And she sold it after 1 year. The reason she sold it, it was reported in the newspapers. They did an article on her. They called the article, they titled it, "Honey, I Can't Find the Kids." Because so big was her mansion that one of her children were in a few rooms somewhere in the West Wing. The other kid was in the East Wing. The husband was up the top story. She was in the bottom story. It was so big that they never saw one another. And she realized it was breaking up her family. So she sold that house and bought a small house, a tiny house, so she could always see her husband. She could always be close to her kids. They couldn't escape. Because in a small house, you learn how to get on with one another. You learn how to make up. You understand what love is. And the arguments are okay, but you make up afterwards. That is the training we learn in a small house. So one of the reasons why in modern Canada people can't get relationships is because they've grown up in big houses and they've never learned how to get on with each other. It's been too easy to escape and live in your own space in your own room. So it's wonderful for those of you, you know, about my age who grew up in a very small house with uncles and aunties and brothers and sisters running all over the place. Never alone, or hardly ever alone, you learned about relationships. So I'm a great admirer of small houses, not big houses. All the big houses prove is just how rich I am. My house is bigger than your house. Nah, 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 nah. It's just pride and conceit, that's all. Small houses rock. They're beautiful. And you learn how to love one another if you live in small houses. And you learn about the relationships which you have with other people. You can learn to love one another. And it's also one of the things I found, you know, with relationships is, why in relationships do people compete so much? And I think one of the reasons is, nothing in our education system. Because I've noticed in education, I think it's obviously true because I was a teacher, you have to compete with your best friend. And every year at school, when you do your exam, you know that your best friend is also doing that exam and you're competing with each other. And that's a terrible thing, that people you care for and love, you know, you're basically fighting one another for the place at the university. And what that means is we reward competition so great, we're really good at competing with each other. And then you go into life, you go into, you know, offices, university, you're always competing with each other. In the faculty, you know, in the office politics. We haven't learned how to cooperate with each other. So I made this suggestion. Why don't every year at school and even at university, when we do an exam, 70% is our personal score and 30% is averaged over the class to which we belong. So if the whole class does well, I do well. If the whole class does badly, I do badly, because I get 30% of the average class score. In other words, we're not just rewarding competition, personal achievement. We are also rewarding cooperation. So kids who help one another will all win. They'll all get better marks. And because we are rewarding cooperation in our education system, we will be producing boys and girls who can go into the office, into the faculty, you know, into the workplace, who know how to help one another. Because that is what we'd learnt at school. And you know, in real life, you have to work together. You can't just work against each other. That is bad for the economy. It's bad for the sort of faculty. It's bad for everything. When we just know how to compete. And we've never been trained and rewarded in cooperation. And that means, I'm pretty sure divorce rates will go down. We'll have better relationships with one another. We won't be so competing. We'll have more friends. So these are ways which we can have a better relationship, you know, to each other. And of course, one of the most significant relationships we have in the world is the relationship to ourselves. And the relationship to ourselves, what sort of relationship have you got to yourself with a partner in life? Well, okay, you know, you can get rid of the partner and get another one, but I'll tell you an important secret. All men are the same. If you divorce the one you've got now and get another one, it'll be the same. And a woman, you know, you sort of get rid of the one you're with now and try for another one. All women are the same too. Different chassis, same engine. That's women are women, men are men. It's a waste of time trying to get rid of the one you've got. You might as well stick to them. It's much cheaper than going through a divorce. And anyway... And anyway, when you realize just, you know, that these are the human beings and the people we have to live with. And remember what I said yesterday about the trees? You know, if you've got a crooked tree for a wife, she's beautiful. Don't try and make her perfect. That's a problem in a relationship. We always want to change our husband, change our wife, to make them just what we want rather than appreciating them for what they are. And this is where, you know, this is another story. It started off with the story of one of my friends. Did I do the cure and care story early on? No. One of the kids who grew up with me, the parents brought him to the temple when he was young. When he got to being past his university in medicine, you know, he did a medical degree, became a doctor. He was doing his intern year at the local hospital. And because he'd grown up with me, any problems, he came to talk with me about them. Sri Lankan boy, Sumato his name was, doctor now. And first year, as an intern, he came to see me, and he was devastated. Now, he'd been looking after a young woman with some sort of disease, and she was his first patient who died. And he had to go up to the woman's husband and tell him he had no wife, she died, and that his children, two children, had no mother. And that devastated him. And he felt guilty, although he shouldn't do. He'd done everything he possibly could. But if any of you have been in that position, you always think, maybe I could have done something more. You never know if you could have done something more. So he felt guilty. And he said, "Look, I can't face this anymore. I can't do that again." That was so traumatic, telling the husband, the wife he adored, had died. And his kids had no more mum. He said, "I can't do this job anymore." And that's when I told him, he said, "You've got the wrong idea of what a doctor's job is. If you have the idea a doctor's main priority is to cure their patients, you're going to fail many times. And you're going to go through this again and again and again, because obviously, you're not always going to cure the patients. Some of them have to die. But if you realize the main job as a doctor is not to cure, but to care, you never have to fail. And if your patient dies, they die. Knowing they were cared for. What a beautiful thing that is. And the relations know that their loved one was cared for right to the very end. So please remember, as a doctor, your main purpose in life is to care for people, not to cure them. He got it straight away. He went back to work, great doctor, and actually by caring for people rather than trying to cure them, many, many more people recovered. as you know. But hospitals in Canada, when you get very close to death, are they trying to care for you or are they trying to cure you? With all these very, very extreme and uncomfortable interventions, trying to cure you at all costs, forgetting your main purpose is to care. But that's not just for doctors. That's for wives as well. Your main job is not to cure your husband of his bad habits. It's to care for him. And you, husband, don't try and cure your wife by sending her to plastic surgery, fixing up her nose, fixing up her boobs, fixing up everything. That's not your job, not to cure her, but to care for her. Now, a lot of times the problem is with relationships. We don't sort of care for each other. We want to cure them. Change their habits. Same with mothers and fathers with their children. Are you trying to cure your kid of their bad habits? Or will you try and care for them instead? And if you care for them and care for one another, you'll find all those bad habits tend to vanish anyway. It's caring in a relationship is important, not curing it. And you know that's the same with our attitude to planet Earth and to life itself. Don't try and cure planet Earth. It will get worse. Care for it. And then it will get better. Sometimes that slight different change of attitude changes the whole ball game. We understand the relationship we have to life is to care for life, not to cure it. So, I've gone on to my hour, so I have to have some questions now. So thank you for listening. Now, questions and answers. Who's going to ask the first question? Remember what I said yesterday? The karmic cause for intelligence in your next life is asking questions in this one. For those who never asked a question yesterday, if you don't ask a question today, you won't do well at school in your next life. You never get to Dalhousie in your next life. You better ask some questions quick or you're stuffed. Very good over there. Very good.
Thank you, Ajahn.
Anytime. Is that your question? Next one, please.
Can I ask you a question from yesterday?
Certainly, yeah.
Okay. So you told a story and a joke yesterday. I was a little bit late coming in, and it was the first thing that I heard, and it was a little provocative. It was a story of a woman who had accused an elderly gentleman of rape, and
that was a joke.
I know it was a joke, and yeah. Then the elderly gentleman had confessed to it because he was kind
flattered.
Of flattered. He was 83 or something, and then
the judge.
Officer, the judge, had fined him for lying.
Yeah.
So there was a lot of messages in that joke. And so I was really curious about your use of the joke.
The main purpose of the joke was to show the conceits of elderly men.
Yeah, which I got. I got that. And I kind of wondered because, you do so much work with people who recover from trauma and that kind of thing. And personally, I'm a trauma survivor myself. So you hear things a little bit differently, and you also, in a way, hear something that, could be used in another way. So you say, oh, gosh, someone with negative intent could use this to show that women lie about rape and men who are capable should rape them. This guy thought he was flattered, la, la, la. So I thought, maybe I'll ask Ajahn about those things and just say, what about those things? What about because your stories do get repeated. So
yeah.
So I'm just kind of curious about how you handle those kinds of things.
Yeah. Well, first of all, a joke has to be always looked in its context. Just focusing on one aspect of human nature. And having a relationship, you know, to laugh at oneself and to laugh at life, which is a beautiful way of looking at life. Because sometimes we do take it a little bit too seriously. And even, you know, it's a tough thing for me to say this, but even when bad things happen to you, you know, when a good example is, remember when my father died, my mother was handling it so well, until someone came up and said, oh, you poor thing, what a terrible thing has happened to you. And that reinforced grief in my mother. And I have done many, many, many funerals in my life, and I performed them for Buddhists, and often I've seen little kids come into the funeral parlor, playing around, you know, jumping up and down like little kids do, you know, full of fun because that's their nature. And then they come in and they see mummy and daddy looking just so serious and so sad. And I've seen shock, you know, on the little kid's face. What the heck is going on? And that's where they learn grief from, you know, from their parents. And if we can somehow even change, say, the way we react to, say, the loss of a loved one, and then our children would follow us, and we could abandon this terrible thing which we add on to loss called grief. I was 9 years in the northeast of Thailand, and that was a traditional Buddhist culture which had not been affected by any Western culture. He'd never been colonized. I mentioned in another talk that, you know, in several places where I went in northeast Thailand, I was the first white man these villagers had ever seen. I remember going on alms round as a monk, and people were supposed to be putting food in a bowl, but they're looking at me, and the food was going outside of my bowl, and the dogs were eating it all because they were so shocked at seeing a white person. And in that area of Thailand, in 1974 to 1983, when I lived there, I did so many funerals and never ever saw anyone cry. At the funeral or afterwards, because these were people in the village, you saw them every day. And I got this amazing realization that they did not have grief. They accepted life and death, and they laughed at it. Now that wasn't so diminishing, you know, the death of a person you love. You were seeing it in a different way. And I want to try and make sure people see these other things in a different way. One of my favorite monks, he passed away a few years ago. He was in Malaysia. When his doctor told me this, his oncologist, when the oncologist told him that his cancer was terminal, there was nothing more that they could do for him, he laughed. He burst out laughing. And the doctor had never seen anyone who would actually laugh. He'd seen them smile, but actually laugh when they were told they were terminal. And he did this. And that's the sort of monk I like.
Thank you.
I got the sack from work. Why not?
Hello.
Hi.
When you started to introduce the idea of a relationship to ourselves,
yeah,
I thought that you went off on a story and veered away from that topic. So I wondered if we could come back.
Go back again,
please.
Yeah, the relationship to yourself. Because I'm a monk and I live by myself, when I go to bed at night, I got into the habit. Now, when I tuck myself into the bed, whatever it happens to be, I say goodnight to myself. I say, goodnight, me. And I'm serious. I say, goodnight, me. Have a good sleep. See you in the morning. And when I wake up, I say, good morning, me. It's me again. Have a great day. I make this beautiful relationship to myself. And I told you yesterday about the 20 push-ups. There's another exercise which I teach people, so they can have a beautiful relationship to themselves. Even if you haven't got a partner, no one's around, and you feel a bit lonely. And I encourage you to follow me now. So please, all put your hands out, like me. Hands out, like me. and follow me. Bring them in. Bring them in. Bring them in. Ooh. That's nice. If no one else will give you a hug, you can always give yourself one. And that actually feels good. It's not just feeling good. It's actually encouraging this beautiful relationship to yourself. To care for yourself, to love yourself. By doing silly things like giving yourself a hug. By saying to yourself in the morning, good morning me, have a great day. Now that is developing a new relationship to yourself as something practical. And also, laugh at yourself, as I was mentioning earlier. You know, I told you some of the stupid things I've done in life. And when I do those stupid things in life, I just laugh at myself. And I usually tell other people to share the jokes. And that's one of the great things about humour. It's just laughing at human nature. And number one, you realise you're not alone. We all do stupid things in life. And if you share them, you don't get upset and angry at them. You don't get guilty about them. And the other thing about sort of a relationship to yourself, which is really, really important. You know, you mentioned in the introduction that in 2004 I got given this medal by the local university for my work in the community. And if you're given an award by a university, you know, you've got the best teacher award. You know, how many years ago? Yeah. And so when you get an award, you know, you have to go through a ceremony and they give you the prize and medal in my case. And you have to give a speech. I don't know what your speech was, Veronica, but my speech was, thank you so much for this award. I don't know why you gave it to me, because there's so many other people in the community who do much better work than I do. And I couldn't have done this without the help of, you know, my friends, my loved ones, and everyone else who supports me, but thank you anyway. That was the gist of my speech. Was that like your speech as well? And the next year, because, you know, I'd got this medal, I was invited to the medal ceremony of somebody else. And I thought, well, other people came to my ceremony, I should go to theirs. And the person who got the award that year was this Professor Joffe. And he was he was a head hematologist at our local teaching hospital. And he'd noticed, you know, in this teaching hospital, the people in West Australia got the very best radiation therapy, chemotherapy and surgery. He noticed one thing was missing. Just simple care. So what he did, he used his position and authority to get 6 rooms in the hospital and turned it into an alternative therapy center where you could get reflexology, Reiki, homeopathy, acupuncture, anything weird you can get there for free. I say weird, no, it's not really weird, but that people think it's weird. And the reason he did this was not that he thought, say, acupuncture worked or homeopathy worked, but he knew if those patients, after they'd gone through, say, chemotherapy, and they had someone give them a foot massage for 30 minutes, somebody was caring for them, giving them personal attention. He said, that was why I did this. And because, you know, he was the head of hematology, he kept a record, you know, of the increase in recovery rates for those who went into the center and those who didn't, all done for free. And there was a huge increase in recovery rates when people availed themselves of just care. And because of that, you know, he was given this prize by the local university. And when I heard, you know, the story, I thought, wow, what a courageous guy, because as a scientist, as an oncologist, you have to take a lot of flack, you know, from your colleagues. Homeopathy? Foot massage? This is a hospital, not some sort of temple for the weird. But he stood his ground. It worked. And it wasn't just for the sake of science. It was for all those hundreds of people who had been through his alternative therapy center and had much better recovery rates. And I thought, wow, that was just so inspiring. And when he went up to receive his medal,
He gave his speech. I don't know why you've given this medal to me. There's other people in the community who do much better work than I do. And I couldn't have been able to do this other than the help of my wife and my colleagues. But thank you very much anyway. And I thought, that was my speech. That's what I said last year. And I realized it's everybody's speech whenever you get a medal, whenever you get praise. And I thought, this is wrong. That Professor Jophy deserved that award. And I thought, maybe I deserve my award too. Arunika, there was many intelligent people in this university considered what you'd done, and they decided you deserve that award. And when you say, I don't deserve it, you are offending those very intelligent, considerate people who decided you deserve it. So I realized I did deserve my award. And why is it that I refused such an award? I refused such praise. And I realize this is the problem with our relationship to ourselves. Someone criticizes you, say, oh yeah. And I told a bad joke, oh yeah. I'm just lazy, oh yeah. And they praise you, oh no, I don't deserve that. So I decided to turn that around. And every time someone praises me, I say, thank you, I deserve that. Why are you laughing? What's wrong with that? Because it is changing the way you're taught to do things. You've been taught by our culture, receive the blame, never receive the praise. That is a bad relationship to yourself. So now, the blame in one ear, out the other, the praise, it stops with me. So if this was a good talk, thank you, I deserve that. Now that changes you. When you start to receive praise, especially from your friends and partners. And your friends and partners, you know, keep people honest. You know, if you praise them, they say, oh no. Yes, you deserve that. Accept it. And when you start accepting praise, it changes your life. Your attitude towards yourself is far more respectful. Far happier, far healthier, and if you keep receiving praise, as I said yesterday, you don't get a big head, you get a big heart. You deserve it. Well done. So receive the praise. And that's a great way of changing our culture, where every time someone thanks you, say, oh no, it's nothing. It's not nothing, it's big, you've done something, receive the praise. Otherwise it's just so offensive. And after a while, people won't praise you anymore because it's a waste of time. You don't receive it. They'll only give you the blame because that's what you receive all the time. So whenever you've done something good, someone praises you, you get a medal, get an award, or just get a thank you. Always remember, you deserve that. It's a good way of changing your relationship to yourself. Okay. Was that a good answer? Yeah, I deserve that. thank you. Yeah, that's very good. You're very, very wise to appreciate the great answer.
Thank you so much. I want to ask you to use this opportunity.
You go.
You tell us what is the most important for you in Buddhism. In Buddhism, why you decided to become a Buddhist monk?
Why?
How you define the Buddhist religion, actually. What is the most important things that you can share with us in several minutes?
I think one of them, there's many, many important things which I liked in the Buddhist religion. Now, one of the things was, you know, I always wonder where I came from. And the idea of reincarnation has always really been something I understood ever since I knew myself. It made so much sense to me. You know, the miracle of being born once is, you know, that would really be strange if you're only born once. Why not be born twice, three times, many times? You know, Murphy's Law. If it can happen, it does happen. In other words, it made a lot of sense to me, reincarnation. So I wanted to a religion which included that. Also the law of karma, that you take personal responsibility for things. And if you want happiness, you have to make the happiness. You don't sort of give that responsibility to somebody else. So that was really important for me. And also, just that was when I read, but when I started to see, you know, monks, that they actually were happy, And maybe it was because of that particular time. You know, I used to go to a church. It was cold. It was hard pews. And this was in England. And the priests there, which I saw, were always telling you how bad you were. And there was something really wrong with that. There's very little joy. No jokes. And you can never ask a question. And that sort of stuff I never liked. So when I saw Buddhist monks, you know, you could ask questions of. And they were happy. They were fun to be around. Basically, at that particular time, the Christianity, their marketing strategy was terrible. They've learned a lot more now about marketing. You know, spreading the joy instead of spreading the blame. And that's important in Buddhism as well. And I chose the Buddhist path. But, you know, that's a huge question. So, you know, I can't sort of answer only superficially. But, you know, there's a couple of things. For those of you who don't believe in reincarnation, don't worry about that, because you will believe in reincarnation in your next life. That's another joke. You want to come back with me? You can ask another question.
I want to ask you one thing. I traveled to several Buddhist countries, and to my surprise, people are actually praying to Buddha's image.
Yeah.
The philosophy of Buddhism is not about praying. Buddha is not the god, right?
Yeah, exactly.
What do you think about that? Is just stupidity, or there is something there?
Yeah. Well, actually, they're not really praying to a Buddha statue. But first of all, I would say there's no such thing as a Buddhist country. There's no such thing as an Islamic country or a Christian country. Only people have religions, not countries. And so that's such an important thing for us to understand in this world. Because if we say a country is Christian or a country is Buddhist, we are denying all the other people who don't follow that particular path in that country. People have a religion, not a country. And number two is, you know, when you do see people bowing towards a Buddha statue, sometimes it's just what they've learned. They haven't really got close enough to what Buddhism is. It's just like the person who has not learned how to play the violin properly yet. They're just learning. So, for example, when I bow to a Buddha statue, now what I do is, you don't bow to that lump of metal or that lump of wood. You bow to what it stands for. So this is personal. When I bow three times to a Buddha statue, the first bow is for virtue, you know, for goodness, morality, for ethics. Because that means so much to me in my life. You know, being trustworthy, being honest, you know, being someone you can, you know, you don't have to feel that I'm going to hurt you. And you know, virtue is powerful. So when I bow, it's like I'm putting my head down. Virtue is being raised above me. I am valuing. Worship means finding worth in something. So every time I bow down the first time, I remember the importance of virtue. And that little exercise makes virtue grow ever stronger in me. The next time I bow down to peace. Inner peace. Peace amongst my community. Even like peace in the world. Now trying to find a way between all the different arguing factions, you know, Muslims, Catholics, Anglicans, Jews. How on earth can we get an atheist? How on earth can we live in peace together? And finding little stories like my Buddhist explanation of what do Buddhists think of God. You know, worshipping truth, love, kindness, respect. Make that, you know, the ultimate reality, and then we can agree. So I bow down to peace, and especially the inner peace of meditation. And I realize how important peace is. So when I bow down, I'm reinforcing my commitment to peace. And lastly, the last thing I bow down to is compassion. Because, you know, kindness, when you see compassion, people looking after one another, you know, caring for one another, that's such a beautiful thing in our world. Not just looking after for your own family, you know, for your kids, your own kind, but looking after everybody. Whenever you see these beautiful acts of kindness in the world, they just warm your heart and they give you hope that our world's a good place. And so when I bow down, I remember the importance of compassion. I worship it. And that means that compassion grows stronger in me. So So that's when I bow down, you may think I'm praying to a god, but I'm not. I'm remembering the importance of virtue, peace, and compassion, so they grow stronger in me. And I teach that to all others. You know, there's many sort of Australians never bow down to anything in their life. If I explain it like that, they're bowing all the time. Gives it an explanation, a meaning. Not only that, I remember being invited to an Anglican church, a very top Anglican church in Perth, Christ Church Grammar School, because I knew the Anglican priest there. He's a good friend of Frank Sheehan, Canon Frank Sheehan, and said, why don't you come and do the morning assembly talk at our school? So, yeah, I'm in for that. So I arrived at the school nice and early, and they had all the children, maybe 1,000 of them, into the big hall, first of all. And I had to stand outside with the chaplain and the principal, the headmaster. And the headmaster said, look, we wait outside until everyone is settled down, then we come in into the hall. And then he said, because this is a Christian school, you know, the chaplain and myself will do a little bow to Jesus. But you're a Buddhist, you don't have to bow. And I saw my opportunity. I looked to the principal and said, I demand my right to bow to your Jesus. You know, I'm cheeky like that. You know, I want to make a point. He said, well, you're a Buddhist. But I can always see something, you know, in that image which I can bow to. Now, I don't bow to everything, because otherwise I'd be a Christian. But there's always something I can respect in everybody. And I'm going to bow to what I see in that image, which is really I respect and care for. So we all went in, we all bowed to the image of Jesus. And a few months later, the principal came to our Buddhist monastery and bowed three times to the Buddha. I thought that was a beautiful little gesture there. Now, you may not agree, you know, with everything in some religion or some faith, but you always see something. And that's the summit you bow towards. That's beautiful.
I guess I wanted to ask you that I think I found a lot of peace in my ability to accept things as they are or to ride the wave, as you said earlier. And in my life, I see a lot of people who have a desire to control things and find a lot of suffering from that. And I guess I'm wondering if you think it's possible to help those people see the light, or, and if so, how? Or if that's a path you feel they have to choose on their own?
Yeah, well, that's my job. That's what I'm doing here. You know, I'm always sort of trying to share whatever kindness, whatever wisdom I have, but you don't go pushing that onto people. The evangelical attitude of just forcing people, you know, to believe what I believe, that is a problem in life. So you don't need to force anybody. You just be kind. And if you have a good religion, show it. Don't convince it, other people. Show it by your kindness, you know, by your love, by your hard work, you know, by your wisdom. Share it around. And you know, you don't have to. All the things which I've taught over, you know, today, I told the pastors yesterday, you can use any of this, it's not copyright, you know, in your sermons. And people do that. I remember getting this call from an evangelical Christian. You know, he gave me a call. He said, I just read your book, Open the Door of Your Heart, and Truckload of Dung. He said, I'm going through Australia converting people to Christianity. Can I use your stories in the book? I said, of course you can. It's convert people to being good. So it's the goodness which is important, not the name. The kindness, the love. And no one has a franchise over the air we breathe. You can't own that. How can you own the truth? Can you own love and say, only my religion has it, no one else has it? I like Buddhism because I always think it can really get in deep into it. That's why I'm a Buddhist. For me, it's the best religion. You know, for the Muslim lady in the back there, Islam is the best religion. You know, for Catholicism is the best religion. Marvelous. You know, I don't like Sri Lankan food. I like Western food, but you love Sri Lankan food. You know, which is the best food? The one you like. So you don't really have to say that, no, Sri Lankan food is the best. It's the only food. And I would never say that Western food is the best. It's the only food. So, you know, different things for different people. It's great. In today's world, we have different restaurants, Chinese restaurants. I saw a Mongolian restaurant in the city yesterday. Have all the different restaurants, all the different religions. Get the best from each one. So that's actually how you share things. Does that answer your question, sort of? Okay. Another question? Comment? Complaint? Yes. Wow. Oh, there's one over there afterwards. Yes.
So, do you think it's important to be silly in life? You know, to be just loose and...
I didn't get that. Sorry, could you repeat it?
Do you think it's important to be silly in life? To, like, let loose from the normal?
Important to be what in life?
Silly.
Silly in life? Absolutely.
Why?
Not only... One thing, if you're in a university like this, when you're silly and when you play, you make great discoveries. Because sometimes the way our mind works is just so narrow, it just works on the old tracks. And when you're silly, you're actually just investigating different ways of looking at things. You're playing. And when I was at Cambridge University, in the Department of Physics, they asked you, play with the equipment, play with the equations. Now, do things differently. Be eccentric. Because then you'll actually find different ways of looking at life. And actually make great discoveries when you play around. Not only that, you add this great fun in life. So it's wonderful, actually, you know, not to be too silly in life. Do you remember there was a fellow, there was a book and a movie made about him, Patch Adams. I remember reading about this because Robin Williams died recently, apparently. And this was a real person, a doctor, who would go to work in the hospital, a guy dressed as a fairy. And imagine, you're treating your patient there, and you're dressed as a fairy with a little wand, and you're the doctor. And he was so incredibly eccentric and funny that... So the recovery rates went skyrocketed. It worked. You know, imagine, you know, you just sit, you just had an operation, oh God, I feel terrible. And you see this crazy doctor come in with a red nose. And you can't help laughing. And that cures you. That just increases your endorphins, the immune system goes up. The only trouble was, though, that I remember one of my disciples, she had a hysterectomy. And as soon as, you know, she asked me to visit her, so as soon as I went in to visit her, she said, Ajahn Brahm, please, 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 no jokes. Laughing hurts like hell. I said, it's a waste of time, you shouldn't have invited me. I can't help myself, it's in my nature to be silly. And that's really important. So you be silly in life. You be silly in the office. And then you find... You'll have a lot of esprit de corps amongst the people you work with. You will actually just be very successful in life. Obviously, you know, there's a limit to it. Don't just hurt other people. But I think at the moment we're far too serious in life.
Thank you.
I did see it just, there's a question over there while you're waiting over there. I didn't actually see this when I was in Montreal, but somebody showed me a photo, they emailed it to me, in Montreal, in the bus stops, where people waiting for the bus, instead of just the normal bench covered over, they had swings like you had in the playground when you were school. Is that true? What a great idea. So the businessmen, you know, people going shopping, you're waiting for the bus, instead of sitting down on a chair, you swing backwards and forwards. And in fact, it was so popular, so I was told, so many people, their bus comes, and I take the next bus. I'm enjoying myself. Really, hats off to the Montreal local government for innovating and doing something silly like that. Yeah, question there.
Something completely unrelated. I was actually wondering what your robes are made of and how they're dyed.
My robes are?
What are they made of?
They're made of just ordinary cloth. They're dyed.
Is it cotton? Linen?
Cotton. Yeah, I don't really know, because as a monk, you just, whatever you get, that's what you take. So, it's just cotton. I think it's cotton. It could be linen, it could be plastic, I don't care. As long as it works.
And it comes dyed, does it?
Sorry?
It comes dyed already?
Yeah, or dyed. Sometimes we used to dye the robes ourselves.
Yeah.
And just, they're only a square piece of cloth. Mm-hmm. So they have many different purposes. Now, for example, that I fly a lot, so if there's an aircraft explosion, I can jump out the emergency exit and it's a parachute. And I told a story somewhere, I hope it wasn't here, that, you know, on the way back to Australia, my aircraft, it flies over Syria and Iraq. That's a flight path. And so, you know, if I have to make an emergency landing in Baghdad, or, you know, there's some sort of explosion and we have to go down, you know, I'd be a prime target to be kidnapped and put up for ransom. Number one, I'm an infidel. I'm white. And because I'm well known, you can probably get a good price for me. So I've got my plan already. If I do get shot down, I have to land in Baghdad. I will just cut a little slit in my robe, and it'll be a burqa. And that way, I can go around and without people realizing it's a Buddhist monk underneath. That's called being silly. Isn't it good fun being silly as an old monk? So that's the benefit of a robe. Well, it's great actually when you are wearing a robe like this, you know, instead of just ordinary clothes. Because I remember visiting relations. I was born in England, and I got many relations in the town called Stoke-on-Trent in the Midlands of England. And I was visiting a cousin up there, and in the morning we went for a walk. And I couldn't believe it was Sunday morning, having a walk, and all the other people walking were actually pointing at me and laughing. Now, not sort of ridiculing me, but actually just laughing with me. And I thought, wow, this is amazing. Why are they laughing at me? And my cousin couldn't work it out either. They were like, ha, 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 ha. And then eventually we came to this big billboard of the circus was in town. And I realized that they thought I was one of the clowns. And I didn't mind. I was making people happy. So you have some great fun wearing a robe. Don't always be so serious. Even when this is examination technique. I remember I told you last night that when I was a school teacher in maths, I had to set an exam. And it was, no, I learnt the 70% rule. But also, when I wrote the exam paper, I put a joke in it. A silly joke. You know, it was maths. And it was some trigonometry. And so it started off, two teachers, sit still and be quiet, were standing, or something like that. It was a joke. No, a silly joke, but it was a joke. And I had to pass my exam paper through the principal, the headmaster. And I thought, he's going to take this out for sure. And he called me to his office. He said, well done. You know, it's about time we put a joke in the examination papers. And you know, I had to be, they call the invigilator. You know, all the kids were there with the desk. I had to sit up, you know, with a timer and make sure that no one cheated. And the exam papers were upside down. And all the, you know, that one year, they came in and I said, sit down, get your piece of paper, pencils or paper out. When everyone sat down, looked at the clock and said, now you can turn the exam papers over. You have an hour and a half. And I watched as all these students, really nervous, you know, terrified of the exam, they started reading the exam paper. And when they got to the joke, the expressions on their faces were wonderful. They looked at me and had this big smile on their face, and they smiled, and that was their nervousness gone. And it was really a wonderful experience. You know, that a few of them giggled and laughed. And their maths exam, they did really well. because they relaxed. It wasn't so serious anymore. And so putting a joke in the exam papers was one of my greatest achievements. Do you have jokes in the exam papers in Dalhousie? Or King Edward Island? Prince Edward Island? Why not? Because now the kids, you know, your students, they're terrified. They're really stressed out. They're so tense. How can they perform well? A little joke relaxes everybody, and then they do really well. That's what I do. Any more questions and answers? Any more silly stories? Go on.
I was wondering whether you think there are people who you can't get along with. How, not just you, whether there are people who cannot get along with.
Get along with, okay.
And accommodate, accept, love. And how do you deal with them?
Okay. Now, if there are difficult people around, you can wear them down with kindness. And it does actually work. Because I had the same question thrown at me when I was teaching in prison. And the prisoners, one of the prisoners said, look, you know, that might work in a monastery, you know, where you've got lots of good people. Now, it's unlikely to work in real life, but it certainly can't work in a prison. This is a tough place. There's some animals in this jail. And I took that as a challenge. And I asked him, he said, well, who's the person you hate the most in this prison? The one who's the most difficult to get on with. And he said, it's one particular prison officer. And it was a fortunate situation because this prisoner who said that, his job in the prison was in the administration block, you know, making tea and coffee for all the people in the block. And this prison officer was one of those people he had to make tea and coffee for every day. So I said, okay, this is a great test. And so I said, every time you make a cup of tea or coffee, give him a biscuit or a sandwich, put a lot of love into it. Find out what he likes. Really care. Go the extra mile for that one prison officer and see what happens. And I'd visit every week and get an update. How's it going? Terrible. It's not working. It took actually 3 months. You find out the coffee, how much cream, how much sugar or honey, you know, nice biscuits he liked. You get them from somewhere. And every time, you know, here's your coffee, sir. I hope you like it. He was really kind. Got no response at all until after 3 months. He gave him a cup of coffee just with the cream and the sugar he liked. And he said to the prison officer, I hope you enjoy your coffee, sir. And the prison officer said, ugh. That grunt was a crack in the wall. That grunt was acknowledging this prisoner actually existed, which for a prison officer like that was just a huge breakthrough. And I knew that the rest of the wall would crumble very quickly, and it did within a month. He gave the prison officer a cup of tea or something he liked, a special sandwich. Hope you enjoy the sandwich, sir. And the prison officer turned around and said, thank you. And I was told by the prisoners, there's a grapevine which goes around Australia, that that experiment went all around the prisons in Australia. And people were dumbfounded that that prison officer could say thank you to a prisoner. I won the bet. So it takes a lot of hard work. However, if you can't do that hard work, it's too difficult for you. As I was telling another young lady, that it was a story of the snake. And the story of the snake, that once there was a very bad, mean, malicious snake. He would bite people for fun. His fun, that is, not other people's. They didn't really need to, but he was really a bad snake. So people knew where he lived and would always, you know, go a long way away. Go around him, never go close. But as happens to many people, you know, even they're not religious, when they get old, they start to worry. What happens to people when they die? It's amazing how many old people you find in temples and churches. And so he'd always heard that not far from the hole where he lived was a holy snake. And he'd always scorned religion, you know, throughout his whole life, but now he was old, he thought, I'll just go and check it out. So because he was very proud, this bad snake, he wore a disguise. He wore a raincoat, a hat, and a scarf, and dark glasses so no one would see him. Okay, I'm only making this up, okay. So he went in disguise to see this holy snake. And there he saw this holy snake in a hall, sitting on a table like this, giving a sermon. And he just sat at the back, just listening. And the more he listened, the more it made sense. And the more it made sense, the more he became converted. And by the end of the sermon, the bad snake took off his disguise, and everyone was so surprised to see him. And he went up to the holy snake and said, I've been a bad snake all my life. Please forgive me. I now want to be a good snake. And so the holy snake gave him the 5 Buddhist precepts. Not to kill, not to steal, not to commit adultery, not to lie, not to take alcohol or drugs. I'll be a good Buddhist snake from now on, said the bad snake. And he went down to the hole where he lived. And of course, no one knew he changed his ways. Now, even though he had a World Wildlife Fund and a Greenpeace badge on his chest. No one knew that. And so they all kept a long distance from him. Until one day someone was listening to a talk by Ajahn Brahm on their smartphone with their earplugs in. They walked almost right over this snake. And this bad snake never bit. He just sat there, cross-coiled in meditation with a nice happy smile on his face. They realized that this bad snake had changed. It was a good snake now. So the word got around, so they never minded the snake. They just walked right past him, not paying any attention to him. And then the kids in the local village, they saw this snake and they started to abuse him verbally. What type of snake are you? You're not a real snake. You're just an oversized worm. You're just a creep. Because snakes are creeps, really. You've got no fangs. Show us your fangs if you've got any, you slimy creep. And this was a very proud snake. He didn't like to be called bad names like that, but he couldn't defend himself anymore because he couldn't bite. He just had to take it. And thinking all the time, I could bite any of you. I've got fangs. They're really, really powerful. You just don't know. It's only because of my precepts I'm not hurting you. And because he never responded, those kids started to throw things at the snake. And some of the stones actually hit the snake and bruised it. They hurt. And the snake, if I could only bite one of them, just bite one of them, I could protect myself. But I can't. And then they came closer with sticks and they gave that poor snake a big beating over his back. And the snake had no choice but to take that beating and realized these 5 precepts, non-violence, it's just not practical in the world. You have to fight to defend yourself, he thought. So he painfully crawled up to the holy snake. And the holy snake saw him coming and said, what's happened to you? It's your fault, you stupid holy snake. What do you mean it's my fault? You told me to keep these 5 precepts, not be violent. Look what's happened to me. You can't defend yourself. You've got to fight for yourself in this world. And the holy snake looked at him and said, you stupid snake. You idiot snake. It's true I told you not to bite, but I never told you not to hiss. And that's all the snake needed to do to protect himself, to hiss. And those kids would have run a mile. So, if there are people who are difficult to live with, you don't need to bite, but you can certainly hiss at them. So that's the Buddhist story of hissing. But don't bite. What that means is sometimes you have to stand your ground. Sometimes you have to tell the other person you're going too far. And that's the trouble with many Buddhists. We're actually overly passive. Don't allow that to happen. Be assertive without being aggressive. Does that sort of answer your question?
Good enough.
Pretty much.
Good enough.
Oh, thank you. I deserve that. It's now 8 o'clock. Any last question before we get into trouble? I'll be going to Australia tomorrow night. So, no more questions. You'll have to wait until the next time when I come back to Halifax. And who knows when that might be. The future is uncertain. But if you make good karma, then I might be back soon. It's now up to you. So, thank you for listening.